Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Order is restored. Two guests today. We'll hear from Siddhartha Deb, author of a new book on the rise of the Hindu right in India, talking among other things about Narendra Modi's poor showing in the recent elections. And then we'll hear from New School professor Sean Jacobs on the ANC's poor showing in the recent South African elections. Both of today's interviews contain some authentic New York City ambiance. Sean's from Fort Greene, Brooklyn. Siddhartha's from Harlem. Horns and sirens. Nothing like a little authenticity. India held elections over the 6 weeks ending on June 1st. It is no simple thing to accommodate 642 million voters. The country has a parliamentary system, meaning there's no direct election of the head of the government, the prime minister. In normal times under a parliamentary system, the leader of the party with the majority of seats in the legislative branch becomes the head of government, but this was no normal election. The ruling party, the BJP, is a frankly fascist formation, committed to Hindu supremacy and the repression of the country's 200 million Muslims. But the BJP failed to secure a parliamentary majority, much to the surprise of many, meaning that Modi will have to put together a coalition to remain as prime minister. That will happen, but the resulting government's coherence and strength remain to be seen. My first guest, Siddhartha Deb, is just out with a timely book, a collection of essays called Twilight Prisoners, The Rise of the Hindu Right and the Fall of India, published by Haymarket Books. Where did Modi come from? What are the politics of the BJP? What are he and his party doing to Indian society? Besides journalism, Siddhartha is also a novelist. His most recent work is The Light at the End of the World. Siddhartha Deb talks about the Ram Temple in the city of Ayodhya. It was built on the site of a mosque that was constructed 500 years ago that was destroyed by a Hindu mob in 1992. Hindu fundamentalists believe it was the birthplace of Ram, the principal deity of their religion. Siddhartha Deb. The election. This is not the conversation I was expecting we were going to have, although you seem to have some portent of it when you wrote a piece for the New York Times last month, right?
I did, and I'm never happy when my pessimistic predictions come out right, but I am very happy when my optimistic predictions come out right, and this is one of those moments. Yes, as I wrote in my New York Times piece in the lead up to the elections, it has become very increasingly clear to me that the Hindu right and Modi's agenda isn't really delivering on the ground in terms of the lives of people. And that is finally beginning to have an impact on people who would otherwise vote for the Hindu right. This election result shows that. I think it's clearly not a sweeping victory in the way that the previous two terms for Modi and the BJP were. And yeah, in all likelihood, they will form the government. But I think a change has begun.
Yeah, now the projection is they're going to get 240 seats as we're recording this on Tuesday. That's short of a 272 majority, but their allies will take them over the top. Now, who are these allies? And will this be a stable coalition?
It's not going to be stable and authoritarian and monolithic in the way that the past two Modi terms have been. It's not just the tensions that come from having a coalition government as opposed to absolute dominant majority, and all of it headlined by Modi. That is changed, right? So there are the coalition partners. There is the fact that the opposition will be much more confident now, having seen these ground results. And the ground results are massive, given that the BJP and the Hindu right pretty much own the electoral landscape. The election commission is a puppet in their hands. The media is completely pro-Modi. It's like the lapdog of the Modi government. The money that the BJP has been able to pour into its election campaigns is immense. The opposition couldn't even compete there. And with all that, they haven't been able to get this absolute majority by themselves. So that is going to embolden the opposition. That is going to have, there will be tension in the coalition government. But the other thing that will happen is that now there will be tensions within the BJP itself. And that will be between Modi and other contenders for the right to lead this right-wing set of organizations. So there are going to be cracks that will open up between the Modi and Amit Shah. Their rule has been totally dominant over the party itself. that is, I think we're going to see some tensions, cracks out there.
India has come a long way from its old self-description as a socialist, secular, democratic republic. But before we get to Modi and the BJP, how accurate was that self-image, and what led up to the current regime? Were there foreshadowings of this?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I have to say, I mean, I want to get personal. It is sad for me to see that India, that socialist, secular, third world is non-aligned. I think that is very important. You don't hear these words, but an India that would historically have, at least on the international stage, would have solidarity with Palestine, regardless of whether you're Hindu, Muslim, or Christian. I mean, it was just a given that you would have solidarity with Palestine, that you would have solidarity with the apartheid struggle in South Africa, that you would have solidarity with the civil rights movement in the United States. I mean, that was a big part of India's sense of itself in the world, even among its elite. But at home, so someone like Nehru, India's first prime minister, he was very, very good internationally. His record was pretty good in terms of principles, in terms of politics. But, you know, in India, he was a kind of a dominant, hegemonic, monolithic figure, unleashed, police and troops on dissenting movements in India, whether they were separatist, whether they were communist, whether they were democratically elected communist governments. So, yes, India was never really a socialist. There were pockets of it, like Kerala, which probably came closer, or Tripura, where in the northeast, which came a little bit closer to that kind of redistribution. Unions, the importance of trade unions. But overall, India is a casteist, oligarchic state long before the BJP. What allowed the BJP or the Hindu right to rise is in some sense essentially the collapse of the international left with the disappearance of the Soviet Union, the total dominance of neoliberalism and the United States from the 90s onwards, the rise of India as it sort of locked onto United States and information technology, markets, global capital flows. And these were the things that led up to the rise of the Hindu right. So yeah, India has always been a very, very violent, unequal country. And I've always had a quarrel with it well before the Hindu right came to power.
Let's talk some about the history of the BJP, which it's not reckless to call it fascist.
No.
And its relation to the RSS. I'll stick with the initials because I'm afraid of trying to pronounce the full name.
Yes,
but
yes.
These two organizations, how are they related? What's their history?
The RSS is the one ring that rules them all. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the Lord of the Rings, but you know, I like my pop culture trilogy. The RSS is the sort of the lodestone. It is the original organization. It was formed in the 1920s. It's going to celebrate a centennial, I think, next year. It was explicitly inspired by the Nazis and the Italian fascists. Among its founding figures, Gold Walker was a great admirer of Nazi Germany and its idea of Aryanness and the whole idea of a pure homeland. And he was very clear that India's Muslims are equivalent to Germany's Jews. This is the original formation. It was a paramilitary organization. It was not anti-colonial ever. It collaborated very, very nicely. And the British, again, and this is where the complicity of the West comes up. The West, the British were very happy to let them operate within their fiefdom. They were very central to the violence that took place after the withdrawal of the British from the Indian subcontinent in 1947, the formation of India and Pakistan. RSS mobs were involved in, you know, the incredible violence against people, the violence against women, the mass sort of, you know, refugees that were produced among everybody, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs. This is the history of the RSS. And then, of course, right after India became independent from British rule in 1947, soon after, the year after, Mahatma Gandhi was assassinated by a Hindu right assassin who the RSS very conveniently says had left the organization just before he carried out the hit job. The RSS was banned shortly after by Nehru. Eventually, it was allowed to become a legitimate entity. It had to produce a written constitution. It apparently didn't have a written constitution or written membership roles. It's very similar to the KKK. I think they come around at the same time, often similar anxieties about a once dominant group of people, upper caste Hindus mostly in the West and the North, feeling threatened by Muslims, feeling threatened by the oppressed castes, feeling threatened by the plurality of India. There was a political party called the Jan Sangh, which was its political front. The Jan Sangh gave way to the BJP in the 1980s. So the BJP is the political front of the RSS. So which means is that almost every major BJP figure is an RSS member. This includes Narendra Modi, who started his career as an RSS organizer from the ranks. But there are many powerful RSS figures who are not members of the BJP. They do not stand in parliament, but it's a shadow state. It's a kind of a deep state within the state. And the BJP is simply its political front. And at a certain point of time from the late 80s onwards, it became clear to them that they had an opportunity to seize the political state, to actually win elections. You know, until then, it was laughable. The BJP had, I think, two seats in the national parliament in 1986.
And now a history of Modi himself, who rose from running a tea stall to being the second three-term prime minister in Indian history. What was the course of his rise?
Yeah, much is made about the tea stall for one particular reason, because Western liberal journalists from Robert Kaplan onwards, who did a very favoring, fawning, almost profile of Modi for the Atlantic Monthly.
Even Barack Obama participated in that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there has been no American administration that has not embraced Modi once he became prime minister. Every single U.S. president, whether they are Republican or Democrat, have embraced Modi. And it's not just the electoral, it's also the Western mainstream media. I write for the New York Times, but the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, all of them, they all participated because Modi had fantastic anti-communist, anti-left, anti-union credentials, and that the Western mainstream loves. He is a big businessman that they love. The violence, sometimes they get a little uneasy about it. But yeah, what is Modi's trajectory? And Modi's trajectory is quite fascinating. It is a kind of an India story. He is from outside of the elites in some way. There's no arguing against that. But, you know, he was an RSS organizer. The tea stall is a very small part of his career. He was a very devoted RSS organizer. The Indian thinker Ashish Nandi, whom I quote in my essay on Modi, I think this remembers meeting Modi as a young organizer. And Nandi, you know, works with histories of psychoanalysis.
Oh, yeah, that's a really interesting passage where he really documents a fascist personality structure.
He's not using it as a term of abuse. He's using it in the clinical sense. Modi essentially rose through the ranks. And one of the things that gave the BJP, that changed it from this moribund party with two seats in the parliament to a major force internally was when they decided to concoct this campaign for the Ram Temple in Ayodhya, which was finally inaugurated earlier this year. And of course, in the book, I describe my own journey to my reporting trip to Ayodhya and the Ram Temple a couple of years ago.
And it's remarkable that the BJP lost that seat, right?
That is true. That is also shows us how things are turning. But again, this is something that I don't think I'm really good, particularly good at predicting. I see myself as a writer and reporter. But, you know, one could see that under the shine, under the glitz, it's a bit on lies and it's hollow. But yeah, Modi's rise was very, very closely connected to the Ram Temple campaign. The rise of the BJP and the rise of Modi are intertwined. He was very active in that. The old guard of the BJP was in power at that point. They did well enough to eventually have the government in 1998, but it was still the old elite in power. And then Modi was made chief minister of Gujarat. He had not actually stood in elections at that time. He was made the chief minister of Gujarat by the RSS rather than the BJP. That tells you how powerful the RSS is. And he was not at that time elected. He was made chief minister, and then eventually he did win an election. He was given an electoral constituency to contest, which he won. Basically, Modi rose to national fame during this incredibly violent series of riots targeting Muslims in 2002. And it was so bad that even Britain and the United States, remember Modi wasn't prime minister at the time, they basically didn't give him a visa to visit the United States because it was the attack on religious freedom was so egregious. But it made Modi incredibly popular to the Indian upper caste Hindu middle classes. They saw him as a strong person, putting Muslims in place because there's this degree, the BJP has managed to stoke this hatred of, stoke hatred as a daily mode of life very well. That is one of the things you notice most about India, that people are full of hate very often. Even sometimes they don't know quite why. People are full of a kind of rage. So it's often a kind of displaced rage. But Modi channeled this beautifully. The Western media swung around. And then, you know, he won the elections in 2014. And then immediately he celebrated it by coming to Madison Square Gardens in New York, where he addressed a massive rally. And then he had years of admiring press from the New York Times, from British and French and American media. He's been invited. India is, I believe, the top buyer of arms now. So India is a very important client for the Western military industrial complex. But that is his rise. He's also, again, I write about it in the essay, he's quite insecure and vain, you know, which is quite fascinating. He doesn't give any interviews to the press. He does not believe in the free press. He doesn't give interviews. But he loves being filmed and photographed and dressing up. He loves cosplay.
Yeah, I once heard that he had a Washington consultant advising him on how to dress.
Yes, he did. But he's kind of, he's gone his own way beyond that. He's almost his own brand. Famously, when Barack Obama went to Delhi and met Modi, he had this suit tailored for himself in Savile Row in London. And remember, these people claimed to be Hindu nationalists, but it had been tailored in London and it was incredibly expensive. And apparently had his name in the pinstripes running down the side, and apparently had its name repeated over and over again as a design motif. So he's a very, very vain and, you know, and vanity and insecurity, narcissism often go together.
I'm speaking with Siddhartha Deb, author of Twilight Prisoners, published by Haymarket. The West has ignored a lot of the violent side, the repressive side of his reign, in part, especially in the early years, because of its own paranoia about the Muslim threat, but also because of the heavy dose of neoliberalism mixed in with the racism and religious fundamentalism. How does he balance this politically? Surely the neoliberal part doesn't have mass appeal. So how does he mix this up?
He's very good. He's very cagey. So, for instance, his second election campaign in 2019, or even earlier, actually, even in the 2014 campaign, he's a little bit like Donald Trump. He can appeal to many different people. So when, say, Modi is meeting, these oligarchs of industry or the think tanks of the West or the G7, he will talk on their terms. He will talk in the way they like, the neoliberalism. He talks a lot about security and cooperation. In India, he makes, when he's on the campaign trail and he's among the poor who are really far removed from the whole banker, Washington consultant, political class, he makes fun of people with air conditioning. He speaks in this sort of double language. Also, he amps up the Muslim hate, the anti-Muslim rhetoric in India for his constituency. You know, he'll make fun of the rich. He'll make fun of the elite, but the old elite, not the new elite that is completely intertwined with him. In the West, he will talk about security. He'll talk about cooperation. He'll talk about yoga. He knows what the West likes. You know, he'll keep the anti-Muslim rhetoric low, or it'll be reframed as security. He'll talk about the markets. He'll talk about efficiency. This is one of the great arguments we've seen from Western media over and over again, that Modi has made the country really efficient. But, you know, Doug, I mean, you go to the country, and yes, there's a lot of air conditioning for the rich. There's a lot of shopping malls and fancy new airports, but nothing really works. The roads get flooded. Even the new airports get flooded. So Modi knows that. But, you know, in India, for his constituency, one of the things he uses is, look how respected we are now in the West. And that is very hard to argue. I would say that's one part of his claim that is true. It is true that India is now respected by the West for being a violent, oligarchic, neoliberal state. I have seen it in my own life. People don't look down upon you anymore. We have joined the club of imperialist, colonialist nations.
How do the Indian Americans figure into this?
Oh, the Indian Americans are very twisted, although there may be a generational shift happening here, which might be something to be optimistic about. I think people feel tremendously conflicted for various reasons for being here. Migration is difficult. Even when you succeed economically, it is still difficult psychologically. That's something that the American mainstream discourse doesn't seem to allow for. So people feel conflicted. People, on the one hand, you have an incredible amount of material wealth. You are not the most despised minority because of your wealth and class and English and the kind of work that you do. But you are still a minority. You feel disconnected from family and food and friends and ways of life. So you make up with it with this sort of twisted nationalism that India is now rising and we are a part of its rise. And I have to extend this to, I'm sorry to say this, but even if you look at the Indian writers, academics, actors who are so successful now in the West, how few of them have spoken out openly against the Modi regime. So Indian Americans can be really messed up. They can be for Bernie in the US and for Modi in India.
Okay, let's talk about the Muslim situation in a bit more detail. It's 200 million people, about 14% of the population. 200 million people wouldn't be a minority in a lot of countries, but obviously in a country with a population of 1.4 billion, they are a minority. They would be separately, they would be like the seventh or eighth largest country in the world. How have they been subordinated, both in the formal legal dimension and informally in daily life? What are the dimensions of the oppression of Muslims now?
On the one hand, informally, one of the things that the three things that Modi promised and delivered on by the end of his second terms, one was the building of the Ram Temple in Ayodhya, but that is on the site of a demolished mosque. So that was symbolic. It's a symbolic assertion of power that Muslims have no place in India, except they were invaders and now they need to leave or they need to remain subject to their Hindu masters. And that was what the temple was about. And that creates this enormous psychological effect, and it percolates down to the level of the street. The other formal thing that they've done is the Citizenship Amendment Act. And it is a creation of an act that specifically discriminates against Muslims, and in that sense goes against India's constitution, which doesn't allow for discrimination on the basis of anything, religion, race, category, ethnicity, caste, on paper. It doesn't. But the CIA, the Citizenship Amendment Act, created this sort of enormous insecurity in Assam. It fed into a kind of language nationalism there, and led to the disenfranchisement of more than a million Bengali-speaking Muslims who suddenly had to prove that they were citizens. And these are people who don't have access to formal education, don't have access to documents. They are fishermen and agricultural workers living on temporary riverine islands. And, you know, I spent extensive amount of time on there. And, you know, my family's actually origins are in Bangladesh. My father is a refugee from the partition, but my family is Hindu. I would not suffer from something like this just because of having a Hindu name, although some Hindus were caught up in this dragnet as well. But yeah, so the second thing that Modi or the BJP government has done is the Citizenship Amendment Act. And the third thing was Kashmir, which was the third. They had already claimed that Kashmir had, because of the way it was, became a part of the Indian Republic after the departure of the British, Kashmir had a slightly special clause, giving it on paper certain things. On paper. In reality, Kashmir has been an occupied Indian military territory for the last 20 years or more. But Modi did away with that special status. You know, the BJP, the way they would campaign on the streets is that Kashmiris, you know, have rights that you don't have. Muslims have rights that you don't have. So these are the things that they've done formally. But what does it mean at the everyday level? Everyday level, there is just an everyday atmosphere of hatred in the media against Muslims. This is in the way Bollywood films are made, this is there in the television soaps. It's the way Muslims are excluded from jobs, they're excluded from housing. It feels like an apartheid state. I mean, that is the only way to put it. In certain parts of India, to be Muslim is to be in an apartheid state. And that is what they have created. And there are violent lynchings. People are killed on the suspicion of having eaten beef. That's seen as a demarcation between, you know, supposedly Hindus don't eat beef. people are lynched for, you know, they might be bringing cattle home for dairy purposes, for agricultural purposes, which they have legal rights to. They have bought them. And they're just beaten to death by these roving mobs. This is what Modi and the Hindu right have made possible with the complicity of the West and the Indian Americans. Not just the Indian Americans, the British, the Indians in Britain, the Indians in the diaspora as well.
It seems like Modi's aim is to be the next China, among other things. Say what you will about China, they did greatly reduce poverty. That hasn't really happened in the first 10 years of Modi's reign. What are the prospects for this kind of high-tech, rapid growth transformation that he's looking for?
Modi's aim is not to make India the next China at all. They have no interest. The Chinese state is, as you said, not only the poverty, but public health is another place where there is a huge difference between the statistics in India and the statistics in China. That was true before Modi and before the Hindu right as well. But no, India's ambition is not to be China, or Modi's ambition is not to make India like China. Because, in terms of technology, is there an Indian computer brand that you've heard of? A smartphone brand that you heard of? Why not? We are very good at certain aspects of technology, clearly. But why is there no Indian Apple? Why is there no Indian Microsoft? Whereas you can say that the Chinese do actually have and are actively trying to make equivalents of those. In the economic front, what Modi has done is he has a select few crony capitalists who are these oligarchs, people like Adani. He has allowed the banks, and Doug, you are the economics person, so you will understand this better than me. But he has allowed the national banks to lend huge sums of money to these people. He has allowed them to focus on fossil fuel extraction, coal mining is one of them. He's allowed them to build ports. And Modi has used India's power with neighboring countries to allow them to have lucrative contracts. But basically, he's created a class of oligarchs who are very, very devoted to him. But these oligarchs also, they don't have any particular devotion to India. They were there, a lot of the money is already salted away in Swiss banks and in properties in London and New York. In that sense, it could not be more different from China, where we've actually seen the Chinese state, for instance, recently come back very strongly. And it has come down on some of the Chinese oligarchs in order to control its economy more. There is no such China plan. And the West now knows this. One of the things that has changed from the support for India, the rhetoric from about India rising from 20 years ago to now, is that now nobody sees India as having a particularly great plan for business. You know, it's not a place where Walmarts have opened up everywhere. In fact, the retail business has gone to, again, some Indian oligarchs. But India seems to have no plan for climate change. There's a heat wave in Delhi. I think it was 127 last week, at the same time as there were cyclones in Calcutta, where my mother lives. There is no genuine attempt to deal with this. We saw with Modi, handling of the pandemic was incredible. People were just dying on the streets, and well-to-do people were dying in the hospitals. That is very different from the way the Chinese state, authoritarian, went around tackling the pandemic. Modi doesn't want to make India China. The crisis is there is no agenda beyond enriching the oligarchs, making India feel strong and violent and militarily, strong on the world stage, and this rhetoric of hatred against Muslims. Beyond that, there is no vision. There is no idea even of a nation.
A French comment on seeing the initial election results was that this might just cause them to amp up the racism even more intensely. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yes, I think so, because they don't have anything else. Beyond the idea of a Hindu supremacist state and this fantasy of, ancient Hindu science and ancient Hindu capitalism, they don't have anything. They're very good, skilled manipulators of emotions and media. They are very good tacticians on the ground, but they are not visionary. And I guess that is true of fascists everywhere. There is really no plan beyond to bring back the great time when men were strong, and the minorities were in their rightful place in the bottom of the ladder. I mean, the fantasy is quite thin, when you really look down deep into it. They don't have anything.
That was Siddhartha Deb, author of Twilight Prisoners, The Rise of the Hindu Right and the Fall of India, published by Haymarket Books. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the scherzo from Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 11, performed by the Sorrel Quartet. It may be the least playful scherzo I've ever heard. Next, South Africa, where another ruling party had a bad election. The African National Congress, which led the country out of apartheid and dominated the first 3 decades of its politics as a democracy, took a licking, getting only about 40% of the vote. Why? What's that mean for the country's future? Here with some answers is Sean Jacobs. Sean is an associate professor of international affairs at the New School and publisher of Africa is a Country, a webzine he founded in 2009. Sean Jacobs. Looking at the election results, ANC got about 40%, the Democratic Alliance 22%, Zuma's MK 15%, and Malema's Economic Freedom Fighters just under 10%. Before we talk about the ANC's weak showing, who are these other guys? First, the Democratic Alliance. What are they all about?
The Democratic Alliance was formed after 1994. It was historically a white political party that then sort of co-opted voters from firstly the colored community. Then over time, it started to target South African racial terms, black African voters. It even at some point co-opted them as leaders. But the party has a problem, I think, with its internal logic. It's primarily a white political party that cares about maintaining its standards for whites. They just basically mean service levels as they existed under apartheid, which were unequal, to make sure that they work for whites. So they ring fence these services in the suburbs that they run. They run the city of Cape Town, which is sort of their prize. They run the Western Cape province. So that's where the bulk, the majority of the vote came from. They did make some inroads around Johannesburg, the urban areas around Johannesburg. They're the second largest political party there. For the provincial legislature, kind of like a state legislature, where they got something like 28% of the vote and the ANC got 34%. So a very neoliberal party, not interested in transforming South Africa. Some people argue that they've resigned themselves to governing South Africa in that particular way. So anti-poor, anti-black, very reactionary.
Now, 22% is not a small number, though. From what you described, they should have a small number. How'd they manage to get 22?
That's what they've been getting for, I would say, roughly the last 3 elections. They've sort of plateaued out. The white population in South Africa is something like, 10-12%. And then if you can skim off votes from the various, from the colored community, which is just, if you want, like a mixed race black community, and then if you get some of that middle class black vote, these are people who are like essentially the beneficiaries of the post-apartheid order. Very middle class, but they want more. The ANC's idea is we would like to redistribute the wealth. We want to make it more equal. We can talk about that in a minute as to whether or not the ANC does that. But that's not attractive to people who, if you enter the middle class, you start believing in private property. There's a way about the way you think about the poor, and the Democratic Alliance appeals to you. So that makes sense that 2 out of 8 people in South Africa support that party. That makes sense. They've also managed to co-opt Afrikaners. So the Afrikaners who used to vote for the National Party, which is the party of apartheid, they've also managed to co-opt that vote. And they've started appealing to even far-right white voters. So if you're a far-right white voter who at some point you wanted your own Volksstaat, your own country within South Africa for whites only, the DA now also represents you.
Zuma's MK, what's that about?
So Zuma's MK, I mean, this is the big story of the elections, of course. Like you said, you want to hold off speaking about the ANC, but I think inevitably we are speaking about the ANC. Zuma's MK, I mean, it's the story of the election. if the ANC went from 57% to 40%, which is a 16% difference, and Zuma's party picked up something like 15 or 16 of that, that tells you like that's where it went. That's the difference in the elections. The DA stayed the same. The EFF went down by 1%. So all these, the IFP like had a massive like collapse. So it's not like the actual opposition, the actual parliamentary opposition took the votes from the ANC. This movement that was founded 7 months ago, which essentially is a faction of the ANC. So a faction of the ANC took the 15 to 16% away from the ANC. Now, what is that? Some people say the problem with the Zuma thing is that it isn't really a political party. They haven't even held a Congress. There's a lot of debate about who is on their list. Do we know? This is probably just a sort of very personalized conflict that Zuma has with Ramaphosa, who's the president of the country, the president of the ANC. They kicked him out of the ANC because of he brought the party into disrepute. He was convicted of perjury. He is not allowed to run for office. And very crude terms, it's a group of people who wanted to make the ANC into a particular kind of image. They were kicked out of the ANC, or they left the ANC with Zuma, and now they did a protest vote. They didn't necessarily come up with a new project for like how they would like, well, they did in a way for how they think South Africa should be governed. Normally, they look like they believe in a sort of socialist or social democratic government. But when you look closely at what they stand for, I mean, for example, there's a comment by Mbazima Selowa, or Sam Selowa, who used to be the president of KUSATU, where he wrote a piece in the media in South Africa where he said, if the MK party is a left-leaning party, then I'm an ultra-leftist Marxist-Leninist. What is left about sending pregnant girls to Robben Island? So their comment is like, if a girl becomes pregnant in school, you send her to Robben Island, or a return to feudal times where traditional leaders reigned supreme. They want the death penalty. They want more power for traditional leaders. What's left about that?
The MK, he took the name from the armed wing of the ANC during the apartheid period, right?
Yes. So that's another thing. There are some people who think they probably still voted for the ANC because they voted for Zuma, because what he did, as you rightly point out, he took a trademark of the ANC, which is their arm wing, of which he was once a member, and just decided to name his party that name. The ANC, I think they made a strategic blunder. They took him to court over the name and just gave him more attention. He's sort of playing around or benefiting from the idea that his followers might think that he's the real ANC, or he's associated with the ANC. Because the issue with both the MK and this other smaller party, the EFF, and the ANC, is that they all claim that they are the mantle of the ANC.
And okay, now what about the EFF and Julius Malema?
So the EFF is really like the disappointment of the election. Since they've arrived on the scene, 2013, I think it was, when they emerged in the wake of Marikana, which they stood very strong with the families of the mine workers who had been murdered by the police when they were just asking for better service conditions as well as wages. The EFF stood by them very publicly, then formed a political party, talked about the racial political economy of South Africa very explicitly, then used parliament to go after Jacob Zuma. They should take some credit for eventually forcing the ANC's hand to get Jacob Zuma electorally, using the ANC's Congress to get him out of the presidency. But at the same time, I think while they have these radical noises, they've at local government level, they have served in certain local governments as a coalition partner, either with the ANC or even with the DA. Their reign, if you want, in government has been seen as very disruptive. You know, and I'm not just talking about preventing government from taking place, but also fights, like little fights in the legislature. Secondly, they've also had their own corruption scandals, this including a banking scandal. Thirdly, there's a lot of debates about the discrepancy between the language they use, the kind of socialist language, and the way that they live. So the same thing that they accuse the ANC of, the sort of conspicuous consumption, the way you live doesn't add up to what you're earning. So obviously there's a whiff of corruption. And then I think finally just Julius Malema himself, who just comes across like it's a bit of a personality cult. And so what happened to the EFF at this election, they went down by 1%, but that's not their real story. Their real story is people thought they were going to get something like 15 to 20% of the vote. And the fact that they didn't get it, that shows that there's a failure there. Malema, unfortunately, as I understand, he does not want to step aside as leader. There are other capable leaders there, people who watch South Africa closely. They must have heard of a guy called Ndlozi or Floyd Shivambu. These are other leaders of the EFF that are a little bit more ethical, that are better. But I think Malema's, the force of Malema's personality and just the kind of ego that goes with that, I don't think he's stepping aside. So for them, I think the election was a disappointment. They did well in some provinces, in smaller provinces, like the Northern Cape, but they didn't do well overall.
Okay, now the ANC. This 40% is not really a surprise. It was thought they're not going to do very well. But why did they do so poorly?
If you weren't paying attention to South Africa, one would have underestimated how unpopular the ANC was. Now, having said that, to go back to my earlier point, the results for the people who were campaigning against them, the original opposition, if you want the parliamentary opposition, they didn't lose very much of votes to those parties. There's some places where voters did show their displeasure with the ANC and with the ANC's government, but the truth is, for the bulk of it, KwaZulu-Natal, where they lost spectacularly, the MK got something like 45% of the vote. They got in the low teens. And then, as we know, nationally, as I said already, they went down from 57 to 41. You could argue that, yes, the ANC was very unpopular because of its neoliberal policies that, despite all their rhetoric, the economic model that they employed, despite the fact that people like to say that this is a government with a very capitalist model, but also at the same time operates one of the world's most effective welfare states, welfare payments to poor families, pensions, and so on. But it was very much a party that was governing neoliberally. But then when it was governing neoliberally, it wasn't even doing those things that it would do neoliberally. It couldn't supply people electricity. The unemployment rate is quite high. And if you couple that with corruption, this is why they became so unpopular. But I still think one has to be careful about saying people voted against them, because the largest chunk of the vote against them did not come from the official opposition or their supporters. It came from this, from another party that is part of the ANC. So if you add up together, if you take the ANC's 40%, you add the EFF's tally, and you add MK, then it's still 65%. So parties who are aligned to the ANC still get 65% of the vote. So that idea of what the ANC represents is still the majority party in a way.
I'm speaking with Sean Jacobs, Associate Professor of International Affairs at the New School and publisher of Africa is a Country. Now, the turnout was weak by South African standards, about not quite as bad as the U.S., but pretty low compared to the early elections just after apartheid. Is there just a mass disengagement from politics?
You're onto something, which is the poll went down from 66 to, like, I think by almost 10%. And that's, I think, the other big story. So if like 4 out of 10 people did not turn up to vote, who are these people? These are people living in the cities. These are people, young people. I mean, they're so like everywhere else. Young people had shown in recent months until this sort of very opportunistic Zuma move that they are the ones that were making that actual critique, that sort of radical political economic critique of South Africa. They're not participating in elections. They do not have a party representing them. What is happening is that classic thing, which is because nothing else is emerging to sort of capture, particularly from the left, that captures people's attention. What you have is people just stay away from the polls. And so right now you have the scenario that essentially this is a government that only was chosen by half of the people.
Now, has the ANC become another one of those tired center-left parties we've seen so many of which around the world?
I mean, you could say that. Like, I think the ANC's decline, I mean, as some people have pointed out to me in the last couple of days, it's been going on for like a while. Basically, I mean, you could make two arguments. One is that the ANC had become very comfortable. It managed to have these large majorities. It didn't really have to do anything. It was never tested over its ideas. It was never forced to sort of come out clearly with a bunch of things that it was for. Like somebody pointed out to me, on land, a sovereign wealth fund, they didn't have to be accountable. And so I think they just became quite lazy. I don't mean like they didn't work. I just mean they became complacent. They had a majority. They got that majority every time. People thought maybe they'll just get under 50. And I think that's what their expectation also was, because they could afford to. They could afford to do it. The opposition is so bad. The opposition is not even trying to appeal to the majority of South Africans. That caught up with them. But at the same time, this is also, you know, this is a normal occurrence. If you've been in power for like 30 years, which is, I would suppose, like almost one full generation, the people that remember apartheid like I did, I voted for the first time in the 90s and I was in my mid-20s. I'm now middle-aged. So the people who remember that journey of how we got here and that may have this kind of connection to it, they just don't have that connection anymore. And you're dealing with another electorate. The Mandela legacy of the ANC, I think, is way more critical. And I think the ANC failed to understand it. And there are some people in South Africa who say it might not be a bad thing for the ANC to go into opposition and to sort of go back to basics, if you want.
Is there an issue with the party leadership? Is it still led by the people who were veterans of the anti-apartheid struggle? Have they been able to bring some younger people up into the upper ranks?
I mean, the people who run it now, I would say, are mostly people who have their backgrounds either in the United Democratic Front, meaning the movement of the 1980s, the sort of mass social movement politics of the 80s. So you assume that they would understand this kind of a more sort of popular democratic notion of renewal, of both building social movements, bringing in younger people. I mean, Ramaphosa helped found the National Union of Mine Workers, which then led a strike, which they lost in 1987, but then introduced the idea of trade unions were politicized, building on the sort of COSATU that was formed 2 years before that. So NUM is its biggest component. So it's not the exiles, it's not the people who are on Robben Island. It's essentially people who come from the UDF. But at the same time, it seems that the ANC was unable to sort of tap into the politics of the young people from Fees Must Fall, Roads Must Fall, 2015, 2017. It's had a feeling that they didn't understand that they needed to capture some of the energy, some of the critique that came with that. I think that's been a major problem of the ANC.
And what kind of government can emerge from this? I imagine there's going to have to be some coalition, but will it be weak and divided?
The issue with the coalitions are, like, there's a number of options. I mean, obviously, I mentioned that 65% of the electorate voted for parties who all claim the legacy of the ANC. Naturally, you would assume that would be the ANC forming a coalition with the MK party of Zuma and the EFF. But obviously, the conflict with Zuma is personalized. He doesn't like Ramaphosa. Nobody in South Africa, even I think their own supporters, think that they will last. Somebody got murdered in KwaZulu-Natal, one of their members. So there's probably already jockeying for positions. That part of the country it's very common for political assassinations to happen there. So I don't know about that coalition. The one that's touted by the media, by business, and also like the boosters of the DA, they talk this coalition up. That's a coalition between the ANC and the Democratic Party. There's two ways to look at that. In a negative way, that's the end nominally and policy-wise of an explicitly left project in South Africa for the state. You read all this kind of stories about how the DA would like to run the finance ministry, the infrastructural ministry. They want to be in charge of parliamentary business, etc. There's a sense in which how South Africa gets governed is, if it isn't already neoliberal while using left-wing rhetoric, then it's going to be just like zero-sum right-wing politics, economic politics, which is what the DA does in the Western Cape. So that's the ideal outcome, I think, that everybody, the sort of mainstream would like. The problem for them is there is a lot of opposition to that. There is not a lot, but there is significant opposition to that within the ANC, obviously from the unions. But the problem in South Africa is the unions don't have much power anymore. The traditional unions have been decimated. The unions that are the strongest in South Africa work for the state. So if you're working for the state, you probably just want to keep your job and keep the state running. And regardless of who runs the state, you'll work for the state. The second issue is that, like, to point anybody who is against the possibility of an ANC-DA coalition, to point them as kind of crazy and ultra-leftist, I think that's the tendency within South Africa. The most charitable or most optimistic outcome of that kind of coalition, if you're viewing it from the position of the ANC, of this ANC-DA coalition, is you would imagine that the ANC co-opts the DA, knowing that the DA can never get more than 20%. This is their best chance at being in national government. But at the same point, they might also be changed by that. And so the ANC kind of, in a way, might dispense of that threat from the right. But the ANC is so disorganized. The ANC, I think, has been destroyed by the corruption, by the legacy of Zuma. If you assume that in South Africa, nominally, but also in terms of like how the state governs, that we would have a left-wing or progressive government, you have to think that there's something's going to happen and something's got to give, and none of it looks good. I mean, if you're in business, if you're centrist, this sounds all good. But I think if you're coming from the left, then this is not a great moment.
This kind of environment, this disengagement, disappointment, discrediting of the existing parties, that's often the kind of soil that far-right populist movements grow in. Is there anything like that possible in South Africa?
That's a part of the story that I think when people refer to Zuma as left-wing, and I read earlier the comment by Sam Solowa, is that one of the problems of sort of the failure of the ANC is that it's created this kind of right. And so you have this very socially conservative right who claims to be economically radical of Zuma, but wants to, you know, as I said, ban pregnant girls to Robben Island, bring back the power of indirect rule of traditional leaders, and also ethnic sort of Zulu nationalist politics. In the Western Cape, for example, where the DA governs, not the ANC, so a white party governs, but when people have grievances, they blame the national government, they blame the ANC. And so you see other kinds of ethnic politics. There's a smaller party called the Patriotic Alliance, which is led by a reformed gangster, a colored reformed gangster. And they talk about being marginalized as coloreds. Their three main policy proposals are guarding the in schools, foreigners out, build a wall. Actually, they literally sound like Trump, build a wall, foreigners out, build a wall, and guarding schools. Those are their main planks. There's another party called Action South Africa, which is led by a black South African guy who used to be a mayor under apartheid. That's New York City for you, apartheid. And his main plank is also foreigners out. So xenophobia, capital punishment, very kind of conservative ideas about, you know, the role and place of women in society. And then above all, privatization of essential services, withdrawing the state from the public sphere. These kind of ideas are definitely growing. And by the way, the interesting thing is these ideas come now from black people.
That was Sean Jacobs, Associate Professor of International Affairs at the New School and publisher of Africa is a Country. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Hugh Masekela performing his great hit, Stimula. Till next week, bye. Sihamba ngamalahle Sivele tala kupayi Sangela tawa kuta Hey baby, what is this Zuma malahle Zuma malahle Stimela Sihamba ngamalahle Sivele tala kupa Helele sangi nata wakuta Hey baby, what is this? Oh, my life.